In hindsight, all great ideas are obvious. The big ideas of today will become the market-leading companies in the near future, reimagining every sector of the global economy for the better. Climate, healthcare, food, transportation, housing, energy, and more. Welcome to Obvious Ideas, a podcast exploring the transformation of the fundamental building blocks of life and society. I'm Andrew Beebe, Managing Director at Obvious Ventures. I'm thrilled to bring you a very special episode of the podcast, where you will hear my conversation with the celebrated novelist Kim Stanley Robinson. As I'm sure you know, Stan is regarded as one of the foremost writers of science fiction and climate fiction alive today. His latest novel, The Ministry for the Future, paints a very recognizable picture of a planet beset with climate emergencies. But it also explores solutions, from technologies to societal shifts and governmental interventions, which, as you'll hear, may be less fictional than they first appear. And of course, we will discuss the obvious ideas of the future that may seem crazy today. Stan, so great to meet you, and thanks for coming on Obvious Ideas.
Thanks, Andrew. Good to be here.
I'd love to dive in maybe where you started. I loved the book. I loved the story. Really, what I was pleased by was that you challenged me to think differently, even in my very prescribed view of here's the problem, here are the solutions, this is what we've got to get done, particularly around the politics of it. And, you know, my science degree was political science, so I did not come from a rooted world of the actual science of the climate. But I then turned around and recommended the book to so many people and said, look, it's a very optimistic tale. And they would call me very quickly after the first chapter and say, dude, what are you talking about? You know, that didn't feel too optimistic. And I had, I think, quickly forgotten about the massive catastrophic event in the beginning of the story. You know, not to spoiler alert for anybody, but you open with this wet bulb effect on the planet and how those kinds of events could really catalyze a lot of action and thinking across a political spectrum of responses, from terrorism to awakening to technology. And I'm just wondering, it's been a couple of years since the book came out, and we've had not just some wet bulb events, but we've had other clearly climate-related catastrophic events. And yet, I believe we have not seen the wholesale galvanizing that could happen with some of these events. Do you agree with that? And do you think that there's some sort of break point where you need a million people to die all at once? You know, is there some threshold of catastrophe that really galvanizes global attention?
No, I don't think even that would do it. And even in my novel, it begins with a catastrophe of a heat and humidity combination, a wet bulb 35, and power grid goes out. People are going to die. It's important to make that point as viscerally as possible, because this was not known as an effect in, say, 2016 or 17 when I first heard about it. My impression is that the medical community and the climate community, the scientists involved, kind of got together and began to talk about things they had always known and put it into a new configuration. And the reason this was important was there were people at that time talking about adaptation to anything, like a kind of eco-modernist. Why should we worry? Humans are adaptable. We will tech our way out of it. And so who cares if we shoot by the 1.5 degree or the 2 degree global average rise? These are arbitrary, etc. Well, no, that's not true. Humans can't survive a wet bulb 35 temperature. So there is an upper limit. There's planetary boundaries, as Johan Rockström talks about. There's also human biological boundaries, and we're not good in humid heat. There's an upper limit there that we are not adapted for, and we can't adapt. Electricity is the only thing that would save us, and that goes away. So I wanted to start with that. But even in my novel, it doesn't change things. People say, well, that happened in India. That happened to people with bad grids. It won't happen to us. We're very good at thinking, okay, that's happening, but it won't happen to me. It must be some kind of evolutionary survival mechanism to keep you sane when clearly things are going to happen to you, but you can't quite believe it till it does. So in my novel, and I think in reality, it won't be that way. There won't be an event where everybody says, oh my gosh, we have to cope with climate change. I think it's the drumbeat. I think it's a change in the structure of feeling, the common sense of one's time. I think these are the things that are already changing, that we're in a different state of consciousness as a global mind. Even since I wrote Ministry for the Future, things are vastly changed. So it's a quickly evolving situation.
Yeah, can you tell me about that? You've said that your novel describes the next half of the century going well, which I think by and large, by the end, I agree. But you've also said that since writing it, you've seen some areas of hope and improvement. Describe that for me. What has gotten that much better?
Yeah. Well, I wrote it when Trump was president. And climate change at that point, 2019, it felt like climate change was always on the back burner. And in the novel, I have this one sentence, the 2030s were zombie years. Well, I can't imagine writing that sentence now. That just isn't going to be the way things play out. And of course, as a best case scenario, I wanted to include lots of bad things and suggest that we could get to a good place in the end, despite lots of resistance and failures and disasters happening. So I may have written that sentence in a dark mood. But since then, Trump has lost, Bolsonaro has lost to Lula. That's really important. And then crucially, the pandemic. That was a slap in the face. That taught us things about global response, about the fact that biosphere could hurt you, change your life, kill you, or at least put you at home and kill your job, that everything could change on a dime, and also that then the scientific community could very quickly come up with appropriate vaccines, and the public health thing got to be more of a mess. But at first, when people were scared for their lives, they were compliant with a social protocol that was pretty impressive. And so now, having come through all that, we look at climate change. Pakistan was flooded like unbelievably, and there will be a drumbeat of climate disasters beating on us, and we're in a different state of awareness about it. The COPs are huge events reported everywhere. I have the impression that it has become the main story of our time, and even things like Russia's invasion of Ukraine become subsumed underneath the climate catastrophe stories. In other words, some petrostates are going to go crazy because they're caught in a double bind. And so we have to deal with that as part of decarbonizing. To say things are better than they were in 2019 is not actually a very high bar.
Yeah, fair point. I mean, typically, as a student of politics, I always say I feel bad, only jokingly, for the folks who are really resisting addressing climate change because they're just more wrong every day. You know, you could fight on a lot of political issues like taxes or something. And, you know, you might be right some days and wrong some days with climate. You're just more wrong every day. So the question is, how much longer do you plan to hold your job before you either have to have that come to Jesus moment or just step aside? So we have, you know, just completed yet another COP meeting where progress was made, but it is just a reminder of the heavy weight of global political movements in terms of their ability to build consensus. And I sometimes felt in your story that I guess it took decades, so it's a little bit different, but the ability for people to come together at times felt fantastical. How are we going to get all of these different, very different types of political entities to come together as an example for a common carbon coin, you know, backstop or something?
Well, first I want to note that, like, when you said consensus at COP, that you meant it literally, because a lot of people don't understand this, and the word consensus has this sort of general connotation of, well, everybody agrees, but in this case, it's literal. Everybody has to agree. And the statements signed at the end of every COP need the signature of all 190 nations. Well, that's unusual in politics, as you know. Usually, majority rules or a supermajority, but not everybody. So the fact they get any statements out of that thing is a testament to the work of the diplomats and to the feeling on all the nations' parts that we're in this together and that we're in trouble. So as a benchmark, the Paris Agreement and the COP process is encouraging, but too slow because of that very need for consensus. If the COP process had 40 years to crunch through, it might be adequate, but we only have 10. Well, it's just a very slow process. I thought in my novel that it was a mess all the way through, but the representatives of the nation states included enough people concerned to represent their populations to keep trying to hammer things out, even when there was a lot of cross-chop, a lot of opposition from bad actors of one kind or another, or people who are working in good faith but on bad assumptions. In other words, it's going to be messy, and I presented it as a mess, and that, I think, is realistic as can be. No one ever will say, oh, I was wrong about climate change. I've seen the light. I've changed my mind. They will disappear. They will say, oh, well, it's always been too late, and I was never wrong. This is what people do. But the actual work of the world, I think the book is realistic in this. The central banks are already talking about gathering together something like a carbon coin. This special drawing rights that the International Monetary Fund has established, which is a kind of a quantitative easing done by an international bank, although obviously American-backed, these are real projects with real potential. And this gets to your work to entrain, reward, pay private capital, make doing green work a risk-adjusted highest rate of return. And so there's a financial plan here that is real, that is, given the world that we're in, of global capitalism, of the nation-state system, is crucial to make sure all those forces are on board. We don't have time to change the world system. We are in the world system we are in. How can you get private capital to invest in green projects? This is the big question. So one way would be to change the rubric by which you determine the rate of highest return, and that maybe is called risk-adjusted, and the reinsurance companies are on it. So changing the definition of profit, in effect, to something that includes the fate of future people as well as just that quarterly statement. All these things are happening. Some of them are behind the rest. But I want to go back to special drawing rights, because the International Monetary Fund has already put out nearly $500 billion of money to distressed countries under the table, not much talked about. They certainly don't want people to know about it, because then it looks like foreign aid and certain parties would be upset. But as it is, there are countries that would be failing and they cannot do quantitative easing in their own currency. That would just be hyperinflation. So they need U.S. dollars, in effect. And now that COP27 has set up a bank account for loss and damage, it's empty right now, but it could be filled with special drawing rights. So forces in the world of global finance and of the state finance interface are coming together in interesting ways to try to get us through this.
Do you know the professor at MIT, Yetming Chang? He's a ceramics background and helped create the modern lithium ion phosphate battery. And he's a wonderful evangelist for climate technology. So maybe I'll start with something he told me recently as we talk about the optimistic side here, because I do think there's a lot of reason to be optimistic. He teaches the best and brightest at this wonderful school. And I asked, how many people are focused on climate? He said, well, about 50% of the incoming class say that they want to somehow pursue a career in climate, which I was encouraged by, but I was hoping for an even bigger number. And then he sort of smiled and said, and the other 50%, half of them want to do robotics, and half of them and the other half want to do computer science, but both for climate.
Yeah.
You know, so his view was, this is all the incoming class at MIT on the technology side is focused on. And it really warmed my heart. It certainly was validating of what we've seen in terms of the best and brightest in technology. Even people who are currently today getting laid off from major technology companies in the Bay Area are coming to me, coming to us at Obvious in droves, looking for ways to come over into climate.
Well, remember, a mere decade ago, everybody coming out of the high-end Ivy League schools wanted to go into finance. They wanted to make money. So English majors and math majors and everybody were going to Wall Street and saying, put me to work so that I can make $500,000 a year. Well, okay, we're going to put you to work tearing out the forests of Chile in order to turn it into toilet paper in Japan. Fine, whatever, just let me do it. So the shift over in young people's mindsets to saying, look, I need to work on green projects is already a quick cultural shift. And cultural shifts sometimes are really quick. So I think maybe we're in the midst of one.
I couldn't agree more. When I was an entrepreneur trying to raise money for my first solar company in 2002, I went to traditional venture capitalists. They had backed me in the past. They were supportive, but they would say things like, could you please just go to a mobile gaming company and we'll give you a lot of money. We're just never going to get involved in this crazy solar stuff. Fast forward a decade and a half, and not only do we now have literally, I just saw a great report yesterday, $648 billion new dollars in venture and growth stage focused on climate-oriented businesses, but many of those are dedicated climate-only funds. But we also have many of the generalist funds spinning up specialty areas within their firms. So the kids are excited to do things that actually matter to their future and take control of it. They're also excited by the prospect that they're going to make money doing it.
I sometimes try to make a distinction, and maybe this is just an old hippie talking, between making a living and making a profit. I distrust the idea of profit as being a marker of appropriation and exploitation. This is just a North Star in my political economy that there should be the ability to make your living, a good living. Above that, you should be taxed to the point where you're just at the same state of somebody making a good living. That there should be, in other words, wage parity as part of the game going forward, and more human beings would be interested in that project. Ah, I can make a living. And there isn't somebody who's walking around the earth with 1,500 times as much money as me for doing the same kind of work. So I think that should be part of the project, because you get then climate justice, and the two fused together has a very powerful, I hope, a very powerful traction in the cultural imaginary.
Well, let's talk about that in terms of government spending with that redistribution of wealth. The Inflation Reduction Act, or I call the climate bill more accurately, that we passed last year was, I think, a surprise to a lot of us in the industry. And a welcome one. It has some, I call it the heavy hand of U.S. government spending, meaning it may be indiscriminate in the way it spreads the money, or maybe not the most rifle shot in its effectiveness, but it's a lot of money. What's your reaction to that? How did you feel when it happened? And obviously, versus when you were writing the book under a different administration, it's a very different view. Is it a small step in the right direction, a massive change, a sea change? How do you look at that?
I think it's a sea change. I think it's huge. It is a Green New Deal. Everybody that I've talked to in climate tech who are like you and the people you're supporting, they're looking for ways to make a living and to make a project that scales and does some good in the world. Every single one of those young business people trying to do green work, they are thrilled. They are going to get support through, maybe you can help me with this, the so-called valley of death between a successful pilot project and then an actual business. Is that one of the valleys of death?
100%. We used to, you know, receive a lot of money from the Renewable Energy Lab and some starved of dollars government pools in the early 2000s. And that would get you to that pilot. But from there, you might have utilities saying, great, this sort of works, but we got to go get budgets appropriated. This is going to take forever. We'll see you in 3 years. That is that valley of death that has been so challenging. And as you say, a lot of entities are now showing up because they know that there's a real market and real dollars on the other side, so they can bridge companies through it.
Yeah, and that is big. That means that we're going to see a proliferation in this decade of actual green business. And it's got to be a good thing. And I think for sure that it is. But now I have a question for you. The more and more people, in terms of bridging this gap into being a working technology, are coming to me saying, there can be new nuclear, that little tiny thorium reactors the size of a refrigerator powered up by thorium, not uranium, and also regulated by some international bureau of standards so that you've already jumped the regulatory hurdles with something that everybody's approved, those could be plugged into coal-fired power plants and replace the coal. And we could still use those power plants, but heat the water using these other things. I have no way to rate that claim. And I'm wondering if you're hearing it and if you think there's anything to it.
Yeah. I mean, I was excited to get to this. A long time ago, I wrote a piece when Bill Gates was speaking a great deal about needing miracles, saying, you know, we need miracles. There was even a cover, I think, Fortune magazine with him saying, hey, we just need some miracles and then climate will be solved. And, you know, this is somebody who's dedicating a government, back then, a government-sized portion of money to the effort. So I a lot of respect for him and his wife and what they were doing at the time. But this really got to me in a bad way because I actually didn't feel like that. I felt like we needed scale of a lot of things that we actually know about today. And with scale, we could get a long way there, maybe not 100%, but a long way there. He has subsequently changed that rhetoric a little bit. A lot of people have suggested that telling, especially young folks, you know, if you can't provide a miracle, maybe you shouldn't really come over and get involved, when really the message should be everybody should be getting involved here and everybody has something to offer. And what we really need is scale. And we're seeing that now. I think battery electric vehicles are a great example of this. You know, my car is powered by a whole bunch of basically AAA batteries, right? And that's crazy. And yet it works. And for a long time, Gates and a science advisor that he relies a lot on, Vaclav Smil, said that it was actually technically impossible to do that with today's battery technology. And that was just patently wrong. So I wanted to talk to you about this balance of miracles and scale. And I think nuclear is the perfect intersection of that challenge, or the perfect example, because fission is technology that we understand well and can scale, hypothetically can scale up and down. And yet we've been pretty resistant to it. I see a world where environmentalists are really starting to switch themselves on this and embrace it as a, okay, we've got to do everything we can. Let's try. Let's keep California's facilities open much longer. And then let's drop into some of these. I think what, to your question, I think what a lot of people are really talking about is when you have pre-existing grid infrastructure, how can you not use it? And dropping in a solar farm or a wind farm on a site-specific area doesn't always work. Dropping in certain types of nuclear facilities should, in theory, be pretty straightforward. You know, you might need some water, but you might not need that much else. And if you've got a great deal of infrastructure for distribution, why waste it? You know, my general response is, A, we're early-stage venture capitalists. We tend not to invest in scaling a fusion. I've looked at a bunch of it. I've looked at a fission, and I've looked at a bunch of fusion as well. And, you know, maybe relying more on my political science than actual science, I look at it and just believe that there are at least higher-order bits, you know, things that we could address faster and can have faster impact than some of these solutions. And that has borne out. I remember I was at a TED conference a long time ago when Gates had given a talk saying that solar and batteries, I think he called them like mice nuts or something, just like not, you know, not scalable and not doable and not a solution. And I was surprised by this. And then he talked about some of his nuclear investments. And yet he, in the same breath, essentially said, we have 10 years to solve these problems. And that was something like 8 years ago. And those nuclear facilities are at least 10 years away from being turned on.
Yeah.
I'm definitely in a, yeah, let's go for it on a lot of these different fronts. But let's not look for silver bullets because of the time frame of the politics of it. Maybe Ukraine changes that. Maybe Poland and other countries are going to accelerate timeframes. And maybe that means take some level of physical risk, but they'll look at it as worthwhile.
Well, that's interesting. And I take what you're saying very seriously, that the timeframes involved are maybe out of whack with the scale of the catastrophe coming so fast. On the other hand, it's like you said, all hands on deck. I'm thinking of bridge technologies to get us through the next few to several decades. And nuclear has obvious problems, but some of them are solved by shifting the source of fuel, others by size. I wish that we were in the kind of country where the U.S. Navy could be combined with the Department of Energy. They've had a nuclear program with people living right next to nuclear reactors for 70 years. And when safety is the utmost concern rather than profit, then you have a relatively safe nuclear, and we need to decarbonize so fast that everything that might work should be considered. There should be nothing off limits or no knee-jerk reactions, no mark of Cain on any possible way forward. And as for Gates and his miracles, I mean, he's great. And like you say, he and his wife, their public health moves, the way that he's trying is admirable. And he has a mini review of my book, and he liked my book, and I'm sure that his support of it got many more readers for it. So I'm very appreciative of that. But there's a miniature review that he did that is like 10 seconds as a Twitter gif, where he says, well, this involves things like carbon coin, some kind of socialism, and then sucking water out from under glaciers. I mean, obviously, these won't work, but it's still a good novel. Well, actually, these are the two things most likely to work in my entire book. So I don't trust his judgment of what's possible and what's not. Essentially, when people start talking about the future, they become science fiction writers. And that's interesting. And indeed, venture capital, it's a form of science fiction. What's a plausible enough story to invest in now? Because of the results might be utopian. So it's a form of utopian science fiction. And that's like the only thing that I actually know about from the technical level. So I can judge, and of course it's a generalist type of skill. I can't actually articulate how one does utopian science fiction. And also everybody is a science fiction writer for their own life. They postulate futures, they do scenarios, they try to do things in the present that will get them to a good future. I don't have any advantage over anybody on earth when it comes to talking about the future, but I do recognize it when I see it. And so with Gates, I just had to laugh thinking it's not socialism, it's Keynesianism. The book is profoundly Keynesian. Government and business working together, government driving the process, saying we have to do this for existential reasons, which is to say to survive. And then private business is actually following the lead, taking the money, like from the IRA bill, and running with it and doing the actual work of production. And this has been true throughout the Keynesian period. And this was the downfall of neoliberalism, was to say, government's not important, let us make the decisions, let the market make the decision, which is a kind of a oversimple algorithm and without any judgment of long-term consequences, etc. So,
let me ask you, since you've just accused me of being a science fiction writer for my own future, I'm gonna suggest that maybe you be a venture capitalist for a couple of minutes here. And what are, either from the book or just in general, what are the ideas that if somebody gave you $100 million, where would you, a limited pool of capital where you could make a couple of rifle shot investments, where would you be looking where you feel like today people are not?
Whoa. Well, that's hard. That's why I'm not a venture capitalist. You would need to know things I don't know. I'm so far off the cutting edge, I tell you, it's hard to stay up to the cutting edge. It's moving so fast. I do see a possibility for travel being decarbonized, which is in the book, as you noted. I don't know that it needs $100 million, but in any case, decarbonizing flight, decarbonizing shipping. I think that's interesting and worth following up on. And there's a whole crowd of people who are so ready to go to sea and become sailors. And these would be a combination of college campuses and party houses and working sailing ships. So that's one thing. And then much more than $100 million, you got to give me $100 billion. We need to test whether we can slow down the glaciers in Antarctica and Greenland. As in my novel, they go down there, they drill through the ice, they suck the water up. This is all simple stuff. The oil companies could do it. They do the same thing in much harder conditions in the earth. And once that water is sucked out from underneath the glaciers, would that slow them back down? And if so, that would slow sea level rise to something that is less than catastrophic. and therefore becomes exceedingly important. And that's why I say 100 billion, it would actually be worth it to test this out. It would take navies, it would take government spending. It's not a venture capital project, unless somebody wants to just do a prototype test of the original thing. But actually, scientists have already done that. We know how to drill through ice. We know how to pump water out from underneath. So some kind of larger test would be needed, like Thwaites Glacier, the so-called Doomsday Glacier. If you could slow that one down, it would be proof of concept. And then we might be able to look at our coastal cities and the beaches of the world and not just be saying, goodbye, we've already drowned you.
That's fantastic. I want you to know, we, a while ago, invested in a great electric flight company called Lilium, based in Munich, Germany, now public. They are closer by the day, closer and closer to getting EASA and FAA certification for short distance, but completely zero emission, all electric flight. And we've looked at a lot of others. There are many companies now going after that area. And I think you're spot on. I think it's a terrific space. And then the decarbonization of maritime, Maersk's ships will maybe be the last, but there are many shorter haul, smaller vessels that are getting closer and closer with things like large scale battery swapping, where you can drop containers where the batteries, as you're pulling them off, most are cargo and a couple happen to be batteries, and then you could just have them slow trickle charge while you're moving on to the next location. So a lot of fun stuff happening there. I have two more questions for you so we can wrap here. But the first is, what are you reading to get inspiration about the space? Do you read mainly technical papers? Are you reading other fiction?
No, I can tell you. Well, I am trying to read other fiction when I see it, but that's a random thing. On a regular basis, in my email feeds, I get Bloomberg Green. That's just a daily newsletter every weekday morning. I get a weekday morning feed from the Society of Environmental Journalists, and then also Nature Briefing. I check them out. They always give links or further reading if I'm interested. And I feel somewhat oriented. It's almost like a telegraphic newspaper for people trying to keep up in the realm that we're talking about here, climate change tech, climate change in general, world news. And then also, I should not forget to mention Science News, that now comes every 2 weeks, because that's been my go-to science journalism for 40 years now and has educated me. So these are short form, and then for long form, I go to books that where people are working at some length on a topic, and sometimes they have a extra explanatory, historical, or ideological aspect, philosophical, something like Smil's books, which I think he's a useful tonic, while not being quite right, but I try to keep up. And what I'm realizing is that's a somewhat impossible quest, but one has to be a citizen. And in my particular field of writing science fiction, you have to be a generalist. So I've had to give up on the idea that I'm keeping up and just hang on for dear life. It's like grab the tiger's tail. You can't let go.
I know the feeling. Okay, finally, we end every one of these conversations with a simple question. All of the great ideas are at some point obvious. So come 2030, what are we going to look back at as an obvious idea that today seems totally crazy?
Well, I wish it were true. This is more trying to call it forth than thinking that it might really happen. I would love to see justice, wage parity, that we have all 8 billion of us at an adequacy, that is, all the human needs fulfilled. Food, water, shelter, clothing, healthcare, education, electricity. And then that there's also a ceiling, that's the floor. And then there's also a ceiling that maybe is 10 times that, which would be extremely luxurious as it is. Right now we're at 1,500 times that, but let's say 10 times that. And that strong progressive taxation could accomplish that on both incomes and assets, on both people and on corporations, that we horizontalize power and wealth in this world to where we have a floor of adequacy, a ceiling of enough luxury that you don't need more. And in that world, I believe that there would be an enormous unleashing of human energies that everybody'd feel in the game together, that we would feel like we were all more or less in the same boat rather than some of us being in cardboard shacks and some of us being in ridiculous mansions. That sense of solidarity created by that kind of a wage parity, the 1-to-10 ratio, and I'll point out that the U.S. Navy is 1-to-8 between the able seaman and the admiral, and it's one of the most efficient organizations, good esprit de corps, et cetera, in the whole world. When we get back to that, that will be some kind of post-neoliberal structure of feeling, a space of general sense of the way the world should be that would be, I think, incredibly powerful and great for everyone. Now, I'm not seeing many signs of it right now, but things can break fast.
What a great note to end on. There's a lot of discussion in Silicon Valley about it. We'll see about universal basic income, which I know is just a piece or a version of some of that, at least on the floor side, and maybe more to come on the ceiling side. So thank you so much for that contribution, but also for this entire conversation. I've been a fan from afar, and I was so excited to be able to have this conversation. I've been looking forward to it for a long time.
Well, thank you, Andrew. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope we can do it again sometime and check on see what's happened.
That was novelist Kim Stanley Robinson. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation on this special episode. If you haven't yet read The Ministry for the Future, it's available now. Obvious Ideas is produced by Obvious Ventures in partnership with Pod People. Obvious invests in purpose-driven founders reimagining trillion-dollar industries. To learn more about us and where we invest, head to obvious.com. Special thanks to our production team, Gabe Kleiman, Aniko Steffen, and Emily Brady from Obvious, and the team at Pod People, Rachel King, Amy Mushado, Sam Walker, Madison Lusby, and Adam Ramonda. I'm Andrew Beebe. Thanks for listening.